Welcome to the Memories of a Moonbird podcast, exploring life one story at a time. Hello friends, I'm Daniel Sherrill. Today on the show, she holds multiple degrees in music, has taught in universities from America to Transylvania, and throughout her amazing career has been an honored guest conductor all across the world. She's not only passionate about music and the importance of arts education, but also the human experience itself. Today, she's the director of bands and professor of music at Texas Tech University, and someone I'm proud to call a good friend. Please welcome the incredibly talented Dr. Sarah McCoyne. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you? It's so good to see you.
You too. It's so good to see your face. So for the listeners out there who don't know, Sarah was actually my band director when I was in college back in New York.
It's true. I can't believe it.
And now you're this big famous person in the world.
Oh, please.
So first question, where were you born and raised?
I grew up in Indiana, Carmel, Indiana, just north of Indianapolis.
And what was little Sarah like as a kid?
Oh, man, a little nerd, a perfect little nerd.
So was music always a part of your life growing up?
I think once I got into band and music and stuff, and it was my music teacher that came to me in fifth grade and said, Sarah, you would play the clarinet or the bassoon well. And I'm like, okay. And I went home and I said, Mrs. White said that I would play the bassoon or the clarinet well. And my mother goes, you're not going to play the bassoon. I said, okay. I didn't even know what they were. I said, can I play the clarinet? She goes, okay. So It was not a really dynamic start, but that's how it got started.
Now, when did you fall in love with music enough to want to conduct it?
Early. I loved it. All the way when I started. I mean, I took piano lessons and stuff as a kid before that. But once I started doing that and got okay at it, I just loved it. I mean, it was my way to, it sounds really cheesy, but it's true. And I can still remember sitting and playing my little clarinet and practicing, but it was a way to express, you know, whatever I was feeling back then. Mm. And I just loved it.
And did you travel as a kid with your family?
We sort of came from the same stock, you know. I'm Midwest kid, and I mean, vacations back then, you know, resembled family vacation. So, you know, we went to a place in Wisconsin, up north in Wisconsin on a lake, and we went there a couple summers for a week or two as a family and did that sort of thing. But we never had any extensive travel. I mean, my love for traveling people and cultures and all those good things came kind of later just by experience and design.
Do you remember the first place you traveled outside the United States?
Outside the United States? This Canada. The Canada. I love Canada. No, but no. Does it count? That doesn't
outside
count,
the
right?
Continent. Sorry, outside Canadians. North America.
sorry. I got hired by a friend when I was teaching school, public school. She worked on a cruise ship. And she hired me to be one of the youth counselors. So, yep. And so on my Christmas break, I put on my little Julie McCoy outfit and went and worked on a cruise ship for a couple of weeks. And we went to, I don't know, it was like in the Caribbean, San Juan.
Do you know what the best part of this story is?
Barbados.
That you Julie just McCoy made, outfit. That you just made a love boat reference. <Yeah.
laughs> Well, you got it. So that's good.
That was one of my favorite shows growing up. Are you kidding me?
Captain Steuben. It was Steuben. The best.
Yeah, it was great.
It really Steuben. Was.
Yeah. The original, not the remake, too. Yeah.
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
The remakes are never as good ever.
So, Sarah, what put you on the path to being a band director?
I got my music ed degree from Michigan State, and I taught just like everybody else does. And they have these things in our profession where you can sort of practice conducting because it's a weird thing, right? I mean, you can't really practice in your room.
Well, you can, but yeah.
Well, you can, but it's, you know, everybody sounds great because nobody there. They have these things called conducting symposiums and workshops and so on. And I did a fair number of those kind of in my mid-20s and early 30s. And each one of those just became a developmental stepping stone. It's kind of like a taste, you know. I tell students today, I said they're like conducting seeds. You'll say something and you just... it gets in there and it kind of grows and germinates. But once I got to work with better players, I've always been a very passionate person, and it just touched that and kind of lit that. And I really was intrigued by it. I was nervous about being good enough to do it, but I was very intrigued by it and always moved by it and always learned something. And it just touched part of me that other aspects of doing music, what I was doing, couldn't do. So
how long were you working in the industry before you stopped being nervous that you were good at it and, you know, were recognized for being talented and everything?
What is today? I would say that there's always a little bit of that. You know, I've never been driven by, I just never thought maybe of myself that way. Age is a good leveler and a good experience builder, but man, I always feel like I'm learning.
Do you prefer to work with students at the college level, or would you rather do high school or young kids? Or
I really like kids. I mean, I'm a cheeseball answer also, but I love kids and I love the college age. I mean, I just love college age because they're adults, they're doing what they do. My graduate students are so vibrant and curious and passionate, and it keeps you tied into that, and figuring out how to nurture that is really intriguing and interesting and challenging sometimes.
And do you think that's helped keep you young spirited?
I think so. I hope so. And the students that I have, my undergraduate and graduate students, like in my ensemble that I have, I think they do too. I think anytime you work with younger people, it keeps you younger minded.
So today you are the director of bands at Texas Tech University. And I know that Texas in general is well known as a band loving and competitive state in that genre of music. Where does that fit into comparison with the rest of the country?
While I have the opportunity to offend 49 other states, it really does have, I mean, football and band, by God. It really is very, very well known for having excellent music education. And they invest in it. The infrastructure's big. When I taught high school in Texas, and I had already taught high school in Michigan. And when I got there, I was like, whoa, how do they do that? I mean, it was a whole different level, really. And so it's not there are good teachers. There are great teachers all over the country. And I've been fortunate enough to meet many, 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 many good teachers. But some of the things that has made Texas successful, I think, is the way that they have the schools organized and the support organized through a governing agency, I guess, called the University Interscholastic League. And they legislate and are proactive in getting things on that level of radar. So the support is has been built in. And I don't think a lot of states have that history of level of support.
How important do you think arts education is as part of the curriculum anywhere in the world?
I think it's super important. And I think you're seeing perhaps right now in our society how we could use a little more of that. I think it makes us, it develops more critical thinking skills. It doesn't necessarily mean that everybody that goes through an experience like that or program like that has to go do that for a living. But I think that by doing that sort of activity, whatever it is, art, music, drama,
dance,
any of that stuff, dance, theater, it just develops collaboration and kindness and critical thinking skills and artistic knowledge that will help you go be a better whatever you want to do in life.
Well, I have some questions that will tie into that a little later in the podcast. But for now, what's your main priority as an educator?
I had to answer that question once because I was doing a presentation someplace and I had to think, okay, what do I really want for my students other than play great concerts and play good music and learn things? But I stepped back from that and it was, I wanted to be able to create feelingful, sentient, musical musicians, teachers, and citizens. And I paraphrase my own self because I can't remember the whole quote, but that was the gist of it. Like I want them to be feelingful and smart and kind and citizens of the world and go get it.
And you got two or three Scrabble words in that sentence as well. That's great.
Sentient was a good one.
Yeah. Feelingful. I like it. So has being a woman in a male dominated field been a challenge?
Well,
I mean, I already know the answer, but I want to ask the question.
I don't know. I'll tell you, that's the question I get asked a lot. And, my perspective on that question has changed a lot since I knew you. So when I first started teaching college, I would get, you know, sort of the same question I get today, or a tug on the shoulder or a tap on the shoulder. It says, "We're so glad there's a woman conductor here." And I'm like, how is it being a woman conductor? I'm like, I don't know. I've never been a man. So, but I get asked that still a lot, which should say something. When I was teaching you, I didn't like the idea at all of even anybody bringing it up. And I just wanted to be thought of as a teacher and a conductor and doing my thing and didn't want it to have this other label on top of it.
But the reality is you are a woman in a field that's been traditionally male dominated.
The reality of that is, yes, I caught on to that. and now I understand it a little bit better. I understand that that representation is important. That took me a long time to get to because I didn't want it to be seen as a different thing or as a crutch or as an excuse or as a this or a that. So I still don't wear the mantle, but I can understand why representation is important. I can understand why it serves as a role model for others that want to do it. That's certainly better than it used to be, but I forget the numbers now. They're still low. I mean, they're getting much better, but they're still low.
Well, it's feel like you have an obligation to try and inspire other women to pursue a career in music?
I would like to be able to inspire musicians to pursue music. So when women come up to me and ask a question about being a woman in it, there's generally different questions that come out of that. It's either they're because they're too insecure to do it or they're wondering, you know, I've never been overtly challenged for being a woman. A lot of things that come up, we just had a conversation with about gender bias and the glass ceiling in an online class that I had to teach for like 5 weeks this semester. And I brought in different people from different parts of our profession to talk. And we all talked about that, whether it's not as much an overt thing, like you can't do this because you're one. It's not like that. It's just there's just a little sheen sometimes that you have to get through, or you'll see a different reaction, or it's very, very interesting and it's subtle.
Have you ever experienced sexual harassment of like the, you know, Weinstein kind in your business?
No, nothing like that. No, I wouldn't say harassment. I'd say sometimes there's, you know, maybe an accidental inappropriateness or something, but there's never been an overt thing anywhere close to what we just went through. I don't even know what to say. It's not a big thing. This is going to come across really horrible in this recording. it's going to sound like something terrible happened that I shouldn't talk about.
The band industry, from your perspective, doesn't experience the kind of stuff that Hollywood does. It's not at that kind of level.
Oh, absolutely not. Yeah, no, absolutely not. It's not an institutional thing. It's not, no. In fact, I would say quite the opposite. I would say that in general, there's a ton of support. I mean, we're a small industry when you get right down to it for anything. And it's a small industry. People are supportive. I think it's better hierarchically than it used to be. And I find there's a lot of support and camaraderie within the profession, actually.
What are the best and hardest parts about what you do?
It's a great question. The best parts are easy. It's interacting with students, making music, sharing art, having something that's intangible. There's energy and strength and can be life-changing experiences for everybody when you share something powerful together.
That's beautiful.
You know, and that part's fun. That part is fun. You all work towards a common goal. And in any art, I mean, I would say in acting or anything, there's a element that when it really clicks and when you have that moment beyond it being a good concert or a good performance or a whatever, but when it clicks and
there's nothing like it in the whole world. Yeah.
There's nothing like it. And they'll remember how it feels more than they'll remember, you know, the reality of it. And if you can get a group of people like that to feel, and it's just a bonus when it gets supported, and yeah.
So about the hardest parts? Because my next question was going to be, what percentage of your career is managing politics, people, personalities, and being a parent to your students, and how much is actually directing music? But I'm sure that that's going to fall into some of the hardest parts question as well.
It is. And the first thing I was going to say was politics, but and I can't remember if it was Henry Kissinger, but somebody attributed it to him. So you can find out, you can fact check me. But somebody said when Kissinger was like working as in law or something at Georgetown or somewhere when he went back to Washington, D.C., he said he couldn't wait so he could get out of politics. I love that. And so, yeah, so some of that, and I'm not very good at it at all. I'm much too honest. I'm not good at it. I'm just not good at it. But some of that's really exhausting. You just hope that everybody could
get along.
Get along and be kind and kumbaya. But yeah, politics is kind of a drag sometimes. Sometimes.
Have you achieved your career dream goals, or do you still have stuff on the career bucket list?
I never really thought about my career actually in terms of achieving a goal. It's not like if I do this, man, that makes I've made it. There's stuff that I still think I have to do and still think I'd like to learn and still think I'm not done. And I still get excited by new music and art music and people composing that and being involved with our profession, which are some of the leading composers right now that are writing contemporary art music. That's fun. Hmm. Collaborating with those people is fun. It elevates the art for us. It elevates it for my students. Finding ways to do things differently is more intriguing. Now I have the freedom to, I'm old enough, and it's just trying to find different ways to do things. I feel like I have more to do that way.
What are some of your favorite pieces to conduct?
I like a whole bunch of music, Daniel. I don't know. I just listened to Prince on the bicycle, but I don't think that's the right answer.
yeah, you never know.
You never know. There's some really great composers that there's music that I like. And your listeners may not know any of this, but there's an American composer just recently passed, Michael Coldgrass, who was a conductor, Pulitzer Prize winning composer, educator. He's written a book sort of about freeing yourself to the insecurities of performance in whatever medium. And his pieces, a couple of my favorites, Urban Requiem, which is written for sax, quartet, and winds, about 30 minutes long. And another piece, Winds in a Gual, written based on the writings of Carlos Castaneda. It's just a lot of levels of humanity and meaning in those pieces. And I really like those. I love those pieces.
Well, you mentioned Prince when you were riding your bicycle. I was going to ask you, do you like music outside of band and symphonic music? Like, are you, dancing in your socks to BTS when you get home?
Or there you go. I'm proud of myself for even knowing what that was. So thank you.
Good.
I like all music. I really do. It's hard for me to find something that I don't like, but what I generally try to do, I love things that sound fresh, and that can be anything. It can be jazz. I, go on Apple Music and where it says browse. I mean, that'll send me down a rabbit hole. I just like music that sounds fresh. Contemporary art composers now who are, younger and starting, and the things that have fueled them growing up or different musics maybe than what I listen to. And I just find all that stuff, the synthesis of all that stuff, super inspiring and interesting.
Well, you mentioned earlier about critical thinking. How do you think that music and the arts help people develop critical thinking skills?
I'm sure like a music education person would have all the relevant data for those points. For my non-analytic data-driven response, I think you have to be able to juggle a lot of things at the same time to be able to do what people do. It's like if you see a basketball player and you see a really good basketball player and they know how to dribble and they know how to shoot and they know how to do the things that you do to play basketball. They know the positions, they can read the plays, they can read offense, defense. There are those players. And if you think of a player like that as a sixth man on the bench, maybe who's really good, but not one of the stars. And when you see a star play, it's fluid. They can think ahead of what's coming up, and it's a different level of play. And I think when you're learning to play an instrument and you're thinking about how to do all the mechanics to handle that instrument and make it sound like you want it to, that's not easy. Mm-hmm. And, there's, we live in a world of nuance. So to just your regular person, average listener, that may just sound great. But like to somebody who's really trying to get it down to a level of nuance, that takes a lot of finesse and work. And then on top of that, while they're still learning to do that, you're asking them to think differently and abstractly about notation and expressing that in a way.
Well, I was going to say, you're also asking them to emote and to bring the passion of feeling and what's the music trying to tell? What story is the music trying to tell? And can you express that through your instrument?
Not only can you express that through your instrument, because, you know, let's be honest, the third clarinet part's really not expressing that. It's about being part of an overall, how do you fit inside a team? You know, how do you fit inside this large thing that contributes to that feeling? And what is your musical role? And then beyond that, you have to gain trust with the players so that they feel okay doing that. You know, 100 years ago, the sort of old school way about somebody yelling at you if you made a mistake, that sort of thing, coach's mentality, you know, won't fly today. So you really have to gain their respect and their trust and get beyond the sort of I-centered culture that we are and get them to embrace the we so that you can even get to that moment. And that's why it does make it special when you ask earlier, what's the best part? That's the best part when all that clicks.
Is there a particular piece of music that still to this day, every time you listen to it, makes you cry?
There's a couple. I love Mahler's Rückert Lieder. I'm alone with my song. I won't try and say the German. I love that. I just love that. And I don't know if it makes me cry every time, but it hits me in the feels every time and in a deep place every time. Sometimes when music makes me cry, it's also, you've got to be ready to receive it at that level. And then sometimes it's an extra musical association that you might have with that, you know, that gets you to that place. But I love bittersweet music.
Yeah, me too.
I love bittersweet music. You know, I love light music and stuff, and I love deep music, but bittersweet hits it. There's a depth there.
There's a Twisted Sister version of the theme to Barney that just really gets me right in the
field every single time.
I used to have a playlist on iTunes called Songs to Kill Yourself To.
And
it was like the most depressing music you could ever possibly listen to. And I changed the title because I didn't want to offend anyone who saw my playlist. But now it's just called FDS, which is fucking depressing shit. And it's like this. But anyway, you'd think that human beings, when they're sad, would say, you know what, I'm going to put on some Katy Perry or whatever, some poppy, upbeat bubblegum music to lift me up and make me feel better. But no, when human beings are sad, they want to listen to music that pulls them even further down into the trenches and makes it even and really lets you feel. So at least, I can't say people, actually. Sorry. I don't want to listen to bubblegum music and be happy when I'm sad. I want to listen to like even more sad music.
And, well, isn't it? And you know, the $1 million question is what makes it sad? And like, how does somebody write quote unquote sad music? Or how does somebody write something that touches your soul like that? When 9/11 happened, I still remember this, that two things about that. So 9/11 happened. You remember how that just humanity, you know, shut down and like, you didn't want to hear anything like, and the music that always went, whatever station I was watching, always played Charles Ives' The Unanswered Question, which is sort of this questioning piece about the meaning of life and existence. And it's got dissonant parts. It's got a very tonal, beautiful part. And against it is this, it's a sort of a conversation between these two things. And it is just aching. And they always would cut to a commercial or come back, you know, and that piece was on. And I thought, man, that is like the metaphor for this time, like that piece. And I remember watching a Charlie Rose interview with, who was the conductor of the New York Philharmonic then? It'll come back around to me. But they interviewed him and asked him upon his retirement, said, what's the, kind of same thing you're asking, what's the favorite performance you've ever had? And at the time I thought, oh, what a ridiculous question. This guy's conducted all the major orchestras of the world. You know, he's done the, you know, most breathtaking pieces of all time. How could you possibly, it's like picking a child. Like what, come on. And he didn't hesitate. And he said Brahms Requiem after 9/11. And he just didn't even hesitate. And I got thinking about that. And it's because every person that was in that space needed it.
Yeah.
The performers needed it. The audience was there to be healed. He needed, you know, the performers needed to perform. And so every ingredient to make something special was right there. Everybody needed it. It's not always like that when you go to an event.
Are you talking about Sweden, that conductor, or are you talking about?
No. This is, oh my God. gosh, Sarah, what can I do? Kurt Mazur.
And Zubin mm-hmm. Mehta, that was like who I kind of grew up with when I was a kid.
Right.
My father told me a story, and I don't know if it's actually true, but he told me that in a lot of different orchestras, if a conductor dies, mm-hmm. that the orchestra will play Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings, and they'll play it without a conductor, that the concertmaster will come out and do a downstroke of the bow, and then they'll play the whole piece without a conductor to symbolize the conductor's death. Do you know if that's true or not? Or is that urban myth?
I don't know if it's an urban myth, but I've seen it done. So I don't know if it's everybody or if it's a thing. Or I saw it done with the Chicago Symphony once, and it wasn't for the conductor. It was actually for somebody that had been a long, long time beloved staff member. Like a super, you know, just a beloved staff member that, and I mean, there were people on stage that I knew playing that were actually physically, you know, crying and were emotional. So this person must have meant a great deal to them. And they set the right tone when they, you know, set it up and introduced it, but they did it.
Adagio for Strings is on my FDS list.
It should be. That is a good one. I'm going to give you a couple more for that list because it's a really good one.
I'm going to send you one, but I don't want to talk about it publicly because I have this one piece of music that just tears me up and I don't want to share it with the world. I just want to like have it be a thing that's just for me, you know?
Okay. I want to know what it is.
But I'll send it to you privately.
Okay.
How has COVID-19 affected you and your job?
Oh my goodness. Just pretty much like everybody else. I mean, what a semester. It's affected all of us. I mean, we've been able to perform a little in small groups. Nothing is a big group. So academically speaking, A, I'm glad I have a job. And B, I'm glad we're able to make a little bit of music and do something because the students really need it. They want to be together. I mean, they just want to be together and they can't be. So we started out the semester playing in the parking lot, like around different, the perimeter of the parking lot. It was staged off in different areas.
And everyone's like, what, 6 or 10 feet apart kind of thing? Or?
Yeah, you'd have like a group of five. You'd have like, I had a couple of brass quintets, a couple of woodwind quintets, a group of 10. Woo, that was big. you know, stuff like that, or trios over here. So I had like 4 or 5 spaces that were available to me during my rehearsals. So we started outside until about the 1st of October. And then we were able to come inside, but you can only play, the current science supports that you can play for 30 minutes inside with a bunch of protocols for your instrument. You know, you wear the mask and then you sort of mask your instrument. So there's stuff on your bell and there've been a lot of studies. And so anyway, you can play for 30 minutes and then you're off for 20. And so your day's broken up in this way. But they were still able to function and do. And then we recorded stuff we just finished last week and we'll curate a concert and live stream it.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. I mean, so they're limping along. And the thing that has been rewarding is that I've had a number of kids thank me and everybody, it's not just me, but, you know, thank you for what you're doing. And thank you for focusing on what we can do, not what we can't. Somebody said that, which I thought was, and they said it's been the difference this semester, that sort of stuff. So I couldn't be prouder of the students for handling it and coming up and showing up and practicing and doing and being flexible and, you know, no grumping. And they've been amazing.
How has the systemic racism and the incident with George Floyd affected your area of Texas and the university?
I think it's just in the culture. I don't know if it's just Texas. I mean, I live in a very, very, very conservative part of our state. And our state's already conservative. I was told that we're the second most conservative town in the United States. I don't know how I said, I will do my part to drive it to number 3.
Have you gotten any pushback as a liberal person?
Not overtly, but again, like particularly with my students and stuff, I choose to just not make that an issue. I just feel like I work with and teach students. I mean, academic institutions are inherently more
liberal,
yeah. You know, I mean, I feel like when we use those words today, they're painted with such dynamic, you know, you're either, you know,
it's Howard one Stern. Side or the other. Why did you choose a side?
Yeah. Howard Stern or Rush Limbaugh. I mean, like there's no room for even to say those words and have it interpreted as like a moderate sort of experience.
Well, you know, it's funny. A friend of mine, I was talking to him about this, and he said the biggest problem with America is that we need to bring back the middle.
Yes.
A lot of people have worked so hard to get rid of the middle, and that's where we're failing. And I agree completely.
I do too.
Yeah, I tell people all the time, I'm not embarrassed or about this at all. I am not I'm a registered Democrat, but I am not a left winger. Like, I am a middle of the road person. Me too. I believe in, I believe in a lot of just balance in the world, you know, like you have your thing, I have my thing. We'll find a space to get along and to each their own, as long as we're not hurting anybody without their permission.
Yeah, and, man. You know. Absolutely. And I'd be happy to hear, like, just, I feel the same way. I mean, I'm kind of purple, you know, they want a red and a blue. And so I don't know. I think it's things like that have been fraught with that sort of discourse. As a teacher, I don't talk about it as much. I mean, I got as close, everybody knows me, knows better, because I'm accepting of all the things you would say that would be more democratic. Certainly the most that way, even in my family. But I don't want to push any of that on anybody because I have students of all beliefs. And my job is to teach and bring us together. And I don't want it to be a power position.
Yeah.
As far as that talk, though, and that impacting, it's interesting, be it in college, it is huge. I mean, it's huge everywhere, and it becomes a little bit more inflamed, a little bit more emotionally tinged, I think, sometimes in a university setting.
Well, say, what's the vibe at the university itself? Are people there fairly liberal, or is it more, you know, Confederate flag waving kind of stuff?
Well, it's not quite that, like, as far as I know. But I mean, you've got a fair amount. I mean, it's Texas, you know, and you're, if most of this, most of the student population is probably from Texas. So I think you have a fair amount of both. I'll just say that. And I don't.
But there's not a bunch of violent clashes and stuff like that going on.
It's not like that. I think they have been good about providing opportunity and space and for people to say and do what they need to do and express. And in good old Lubbock, America, they had a march, which I was proud of them. You know, I wasn't sure. It's a extremely conservative environment, but I think there are civil tones that are being met by students. And I know that they care a lot about these issues, a lot.
Well, one of my former guests who's a friend, he's a journalist, Scott Bowles, he said this quote that I think is really brilliant. He said, history leans liberal, and really meaning that over time, things always veer towards the liberal side as we advance as a species. As if you look back over history from thousands of years ago to today, the liberal argument of things has generally won out historically.
It's true.
What I always tell people is whether we like it or not, history will continue to evolve this way because that is, in my opinion, part of the nature of humanity. So you might be someone who has an issue with, let's just say, all the different gender identities today. But whether you like it or not, they're here to stay and they're going to become a part of the everyday life of human beings on this planet. And in 50 years or 100 years, people aren't even going to be thinking about this. You know, I don't think twice about the fact that there's white and black and different colored people in the bathroom with me when I go to IKEA. But how long ago were blacks not allowed to use the same bathroom as me? You know what I mean?
Right.
So the evolution, in my opinion, of life on Earth leans liberal.
It does. And it's an interesting way that he said it, because history is actually the word history. It's about kind of looking back. You know, you're reflecting on what has happened. Mm. But progress, which is really the part of that that's true, that's the stuff that is quote unquote more liberal, because people push to, you know, move stuff forward, or issues or society or injustice. You know, you're trying to create a more perfect union.
Maybe we should say progress leans liberal.
Yeah. So you're trying to create a more perfect union, and history will be the marker of how far you got on that. It's sort of the litmus test, right? And so the marker, you're pushing, and it might get you this far. We're not, for example, in race relations, you know, that ugly little scab got, you know, knocked off in the last 4 years. So like, we aren't as far ahead as maybe I thought we were. I mean, holy cow, you know, and all the unrest that's happened, it's just unbelievable. And so we have some work to do. So, and you know, to me, that we've gone this many steps forward and we kind of came back one, and now we're going to push it again. And history, I think history will be on the side of that.
I like your revision that progress leans liberal. And I know Scott listens to the show. So Scott, we're going to revise your statement to say progress leans liberal.
Scott, I feel like I like you. So it's good.
You would love to sit in a room with Scott Bowles and just talk. He is one of the most intelligent and fantastic human beings you'll ever meet in your entire life.
I bet. I like his his thought. I think that's good.
Well, you should go listen to his episode.
Okay, I will go listen.
Sarah, if you were elected president of the United States tomorrow, what would be the first three things that you would do or put into place?
Well, I'd do something with the whole mask thing.
In what respect?
Well, I believe I would encourage or legislate or do something or find some shockingly collaborative way to get people to like just behave. Like,
you mean wear the masks?
Yes, wear the mask. Wear the damn mask. Like, it's not that hard, you know? Yeah, we need to get this stuff under control. So, I mean, this is a question that's obviously topical right now, but that would be my first thing, I'm quite sure.
I want to sidebar this for a moment and tell you that I think worldwide, it should be a law that if you go outside your home until COVID is under control, you have to wear a mask. And if you are caught not wearing a mask, and that means you and your stupid fucking kids too. And if you're not wearing a mask, the first time you are cited, you get a warning. The second time you are cited, it is a $500 fee per person not wearing a mask. The third time you are caught not wearing a mask, it's a $50,000 fine.
Ooh, nice one.
And the fourth time, you go to jail for 2 years.
You're executed. Yeah.
That okay. I think you are risking other human beings' life for your own selfish, arrogant stupidity. And therefore, the punishment should be very harsh.
I don't disagree with you. I had not worked out my spontaneous answer to the level of punishment.
I've thought about this a lot. Yeah. Because like I have a mother who is, you know, has some health issues that if she got exposed, could die. And so some stupid person out there being like, I have the right to breathe. Well, you can breathe just fine with a mask, you jerk. So just quit trying to hurt my mother. That's the way I look at it. I'm not going to hurt your mother. You don't hurt my mother. That's how it works. So yeah. I'm done with the sidebar. Please continue.
A good sidebar. I mean, and I think that there's something to, if you wanted to back that whole thing up, one other rung. I don't know that you could legislate it, but I think we need to find that place as a country. I'm not quite sure just, you know, on the cuff what I would do, but I think we need to find the place where we are willing to be more of a we society, culture, whatever, than a me. That's been on my mind. People are either, I just had this conversation with somebody the other day too, about there's people that are wonderful people still, but everything comes through an eye filter. Mm-hmm. And I think there's too much of that, like way too much of it.
Well, and social media is not helping that. You should watch
it doesn't help it.
Have you seen The Social Dilemma on Netflix?
No, but somebody just recommended it and told me to watch it.
Yeah, you should. Yeah, you're talking about, Jolene and I talk about this all the time, actually, that, and especially living in Los Angeles, there's a lot of good things about LA. I don't want to just completely crap on LA, but one of the things that sucks about it is that it is a city of people who believe that their life is completely anonymous.
Anonymous?
Anonymous in the fact that, like, when I grew up in Ohio, you don't want to, you know, necessarily beep your horn at somebody right away because that might be the person that's cutting your hair, or it could be the father of the girl you're dating. It's a small town, but in LA where there's 10 million people running around, you can beep at whoever you want. You can be rude. You can be nasty to people because you're never going to see them again. Chances, right?
I see.
And so people walk around with this idea of anonymity, and it really takes accountability away. It takes kindness away. It takes your the whole me thing you're talking about. Yeah. It really does remove this ability for human beings to go, hey, we're all passengers on spaceship Earth, as the saying goes. So I agree. So number two would be we try to find a way to get people to not be so me oriented.
Well, I totally think that. And, you know, I was thinking while you were saying that, because, you know, you are wicked funny. I mean, I know this, remembers this about you. You are so sarcastic and funny. I remember just laughing and laughing and laughing. And you can be sarcastic and cut this or do that and make fun and joke and everything, but there's got to be an underlying somewhere in there. And I get to see more of that with you now, that you have to treat people, you know, you grew up in the Midwest and people make fun of the Midwest, but there's a grounded core of value there, that I'm glad I had growing up.
What would be your third thing?
Okay, so I'm going to fix the entire culture of the country, and I'm going to make everybody wear a mask, and I'm going to hire you to be the enforcer for the fines. That's good. I like that.
All right.
And if you could also work in there some sort of substrate where, like, the nose wears, if you could get those people in your.
And to anybody listening to this podcast right now, if you don't have your mask above your nose, You might as well just take it off. This is basic science. Go look it up.
It's not hard. It's just not hard. The third thing, I mean, I'm sure the answer should be economic growth or prosperity or making small businesses happy or rooting for the little guy. You know, the larger thing would be equity and include, I don't know. I mean, I'm torn between saying some magnanimous thing about the arts and how we have to do something with that. But I do think it's important to be able to provide for the country and encourage everybody, not just the very, very top, although I understand that that's important. It's not that, but and I'm not socialist, but I think that we have to find a way to encourage everybody to be able to contribute to our society.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not quite 100% sure that I have a policy.
Well, what do you think today then, your role as a director of bands and an educator, what is your role in trying to bring positive change to the world?
I would like to think, so I have students, my students are all trying, you know, training for a career, right? So many of them are music educators, many of them are teachers, many of them are going to be working with people. The ones that get to go perform and are trained to go do that and can get it, it's like getting an MBA job, you know, it's hard. But I would like to think that I am helping teach creativity, kindness, art, how to think, how to be, the value of those attributes, how to feel, how to work in a group. I mean, there's all the musical metrics that I want them to get that are important. But the other thing about who you are and how you work and how you function in a group. Sometimes I have these students for 4 years.
So you're not just teaching them music, you're teaching them how to be a better human being.
I would like to think so. And I'd like to think that you're helping develop. I always tell people, you know, I don't have kids either, but I help raise a few million, zillion of them, you know, and I'll be okay with that.
It takes a village.
It takes a village. I'm okay with that. It means a lot to me.
Do you think that the human race will survive and have a bright future? Are you optimistic?
I'm optimistic. I'm always optimistic. I'm a person that doesn't look backwards a lot or try not to, and I look forward. So I've not sat there and pondered that great thought much, but I would like to think that there are enough. I mean, the people you meet and the people you work with and people like you, I mean, there's more good, smart, balanced people out there that matter, that think about things and are and represent these things in a way that they find that value meaningful. So I would say, yes, I am positive.
What's one thing you'd want to impart to the people that listen to this podcast more than anything else?
Oh my gosh, I don't know. I mean, be kind and eat your vegetables. I'm trying to, I don't know that I have one thing to impart. I mean, you know, they seem value driven, but
I like be kind and eat your vegetables, to be honest.
Do you like be kind and eat your vegetables?
I think that's great advice.
It is a good, it's a good one. Maybe don't react quite as quickly as, don't assume, don't be so quick to judge. Somebody said once, and it wasn't me, but those quickest to judge generally have the least information. I love that one.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, that's a good one. It's almost as good as vegetables. But
besides family and friends and career, what are you most passionate about in life today?
Boy, I love learning in all forms and I love people. I mean, I love learning about just about anything. I'm trying to learn Italian now. I told you, I think we've had a couple exchange students the last 3 years and two of them were brother and sister and they were just great. And we became close. Are friends with the family and it was kind of a special thing. It's fun going back and forth, just trying to learn. And it's fun to learn. That's my fun thing, is to sit and do like an hour or two of Italian at night, you know?
What was your favorite childhood book?
Oh, I was like the Bobbsey twins and the Nancy Drew kids, you know, I'd read all the time. So I was an encyclopedia. It depends on how far back you go. You know, I read all the time.
That's cool.
I got little awards. And so,
were you going to say Encyclopedia Brown?
Yes. Love Encyclopedia Brown, like fourth grade. Come
well,
on,
no
man.
Joke. That's one of Scott Bowles' favorites. So you guys should really hang out with me
sometime.
See,
Scott Bowles and I are pals. I can just tell. Yeah, I read all the time. I used to get little awards for how many books I read, you know, when you were in elementary school and stuff. So
that's cool. Yeah. What was the first book you read or the first movie you saw that made you cry?
I read a book I remember that I just absolutely gasped at in eighth grade. I read Sophie's Choice.
Oh, man.
And it got to the end of the choice and I did not see it coming. And man, that one affected me huge. in eighth grade. I used to have dreams about it, actually. And a kid sitting next to me in band, he had, his mother came and talked to our class because she had the tattoo on her wrist.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, John Omer. So all that happened at the same time in that same year. So that was just, that was huge. I still remember that. Movie that made me cry. You know, my dad, the first time I saw my dad cry when I was very young is he was a big Chicago Bears fan. I mean, huge. And he used to watch Brian's Song. Do you remember that? It was about Gale Sayers.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, Brian Piccolo. So, I mean, old.
I really thought a second you were going to be funny and say he saw the video for the Super Bowl Shuffle and then he got all choked up.
No, I'm sure there's a lot of jokes I could make about the Chicago Bears. But he, you know, when you're a little kid and you see your dad cry.
Yeah, it's tough.
You know, you're like 6 years old and like you see your dad cry. So then when I was watching it and then I saw, you know, it's sad. I probably cried then. So, I mean, that's the like littlest one. I remember taking my sister to see E.T. like, and I said, okay, listen, we're not crying at this. I've heard it said, like, you know, and she was a little kid. I was like 19. She's like 9. And I said, we're not, just like, don't. And we got to a part in E.T. and I was like, like, you know, it's so stupid.
It's a great movie.
Oh, it's a great movie. And today I get choked up at commercials. I get choked up. I don't know. It's just because you get older, more compassionate, I think. But
Is it that? Or is it that you get older and you realize you have less days in front of you than you do behind you? And there's just this impending doom of the abyss waiting for you.
I'm waiting. I'm so eager for your playlist right now.
As you look back on your life, how have your priorities changed as you've gotten older?
I'm not sure my priorities have changed because I've always tried to teach well and do well. I think that where I've matured is my reaction to things. And, you know, fundamentally, I was so insecure about being able to do stuff and be good. I think it held me back kind of. Not that I needed to be, you know, hear me roar, but I never was. It was, I think I've been misunderstood sometimes because I think that probably held me back a little bit. I never really felt a need to prove either. I just tried to not suck, you know, trying to like get it done and do a good job. So
that's hilarious. I love it. My priorities haven't changed. I've just continued to try not to suck.
Yeah, pretty much right there.
I'm curious, do you feel a need as an artist to leave something behind of yourself in the world?
That's a great question. I think if I wasn't doing something where I felt like I was giving back, I would be an unhappy person. I feel like that by what I'm doing, I am giving back. I'm trying to give back. And if I have made a difference in, you're not going to make a difference in every kid's life, but every single teacher I know, you do make a difference in people's lives, or, and they're nice enough to say something or a note or this or that, or 10 years later, So I think if I've made some sort of impact positively on a student or two, and in a meaningful way.
No doubt.
That's important to me. And I hope we do. I try.
Well, I have to say, of all the directors I have ever worked with, there are only like 5 or 6 I like better than you.
That's pretty good. I'll take that for a dollar. That's all good. And of all the students I've had, you are one of them.
Oh, God, that's funny. Do you believe in God?
I believe, yes, but I believe that that may be a more liberal interpretation than maybe some people have. I believe that there
I'm still is... laughing about the student thing.
Sorry. You like that? You actually turned red. That was awesome.
I did. That was great. So funny. Sorry. Yeah, back to God.
So
back
from
to God.
That to like even God. Oh, I love that. Yes. I mean, I think that there's a larger purpose for all of us. I mean, I think that there's something out there. And I think so that's where I'll go.
Do you have any pets? And are you a cat or dog lover?
Definitely a dog lover. Come on.
Yeah.
Come on. We're dog lovers. I've learned to embrace people who like cats too. It's okay. And I have a couple.
It's interesting you call them people, but whatever.
I know. It already says a lot about them. I'm not going to judge.
I love when people say, listen, I'm not going to judge. I just tell people, listen, I'm totally going to judge. I'm just not going to do it to your face.
Yeah. Openly judging.
If you can continue to live a healthy life, and I stress healthy, how long do you think you'd like to live?
Oh, wow. As long as I can stay creative and have my marbles about me.
And that includes mental health.
If it's mental health and everything, I don't have an age limit then. If it's mental health and physical health, I'm in.
For the long haul.
I'm going to have to win it. Like, yeah, I'm good.
Do you think you'd ever get tired? Like, I wonder, like, what if I took a magic pill and I could live as long as I wanted? You got to think, like, I'm already a little bit tired and I'm, you know, not even 50. You got to think about 130, 140. You're probably going to be like, all right, enough.
It might be enough.
Yeah.
I'm open to saying that.
Well, are you afraid of dying?
No, unless you know something I don't.
No, I don't. I don't want to have a painful death. Many people have said the same thing. I don't want to suffer.
Yeah, you know, I don't want to suffer. I'm not afraid of it, but I'm not in a position where I have to be afraid of it at the moment. Like, I don't think a meteor is going to hit me, or I'm not worried in the car, or, you know, all the things.
But if there is some magic power in the universe that has control of things and you're listening to me right now, I don't want to die. So,
yeah, just in case it's misinterpreted for those of you in the back,
very clear I'm not about
looking
that.
Forward to it. Yeah.
I'd like
don't
to make it at least
to
100.
Don't tease me about it or anything. Yeah. I'm good. I'm respectful.
Sarah, if you go back in time and meet up with your 16-year-old self, what would you say to her?
Oh, my God. My 16-year-old self, I'd say stop worrying so much. Just trust yourself more. Hmm. Trust yourself more.
Great advice. Do you believe in love?
I do.
What do you think is the purpose of art?
I think it contributes to our humanity. I think it contributes to how it sounds maybe sophomoric, but it makes us kinder, better people. And I'm not exactly 100% sure how that works, but I totally believe that it does do that. I think that the people that go and support art and watch art and look at art and consider art and value performers and value people making a living and their life's work doing that, when sometimes it's not very well valued by society, I think those people operate by a different barometer sometimes, you know, and they're a little kinder and they're a little more gentle and they're a little more accepting and they're a little more excited about how that does add to their life. That's a terrible answer.
No, it's not. It's a great answer. What does success in life look like to you?
I don't have my checklist. I think just learning to be happy and content. And I'm not good at being comfortable. I'm very bad at being comfortable. But being happy and content in whatever you do and make a difference.
Well, do you believe there's a difference between complacent and comfortable?
Yes.
Because I really love being physically comfortable, like sweatpants and a t-shirt. And I mean, I put on a nice shirt for this podcast, and you're welcome.
Did you? This is new. Do you like it?
Is it Lululemon?
No, but thank you for thinking it is. And even better that you know that. No, complacent and comfortable is different. There's physical comfort, but I mean just comfortable in your own skin, you know, and which is also maturity.
Well, do you like yourself?
I'm not bad. I look in there and go, okay, look in the mirror and go, all right.
So Sarah, at the end of every show, as you may know, I do a little thing called 299 Philosophical and Life Questions with Moonbird, where I've collected 299 philosophical and life questions from friends, family, and the internet. You get to pick two numbers. I'll ask you those two numbers and you can answer those questions. What are your two numbers?
163 and 72.
163. Ooh, the first time this question's been asked on the podcast. How exciting. Hold on.
That is exciting.
I love when we get a new one. 163, if you could pick any animal to talk to, which would it be and what would you say first?
Oh, you know what? I would love to talk to an elephant, actually, because they're old and wise. And I think they have more to say than one might give them credit for. I might be compelled to ask them how they work on their wrinkles.
And 72, what's the most exciting thing that's happened this past year?
Oh, God. Let's see.
And I'm going to edit this right now. Hold on. What's the most exciting thing that's happened to you? This question should be, because not in the world. What's the most exciting thing that's happened to you this past year?
Most exciting thing this year? Well, I mean, the COVID thing was not very exciting. You know, this year, I would say, if we're saying 2020, I think sort of the maybe the most fun thing that's happened is we had that exchange kid with us who was just awesome, and we became really close. And she'll listen to this and go, of course, but no, she's awesome. So we really enjoyed having her.
Do you want to give a shout out to her by name? You can.
Hey, Greta. Hi, Lorenzo. They will love that.
Well, Dr. Sarah McCoyne, it's been nothing but a pleasure to have you on the show. And I want to thank you so much for taking the time to be here. And it is awesome to see you again. And I wish you just the very best.
Oh, thank you. And it's been a pleasure to see you. And you're all grown up and doing amazing things. And
thank you. Thank you.
It's just, it's great to see you and connect. And thanks for asking me to do this. It's been really fun.
You take care.
You too.
Friends and listeners, I'd like to thank Sarah for coming in today and also let you know that if you'd like to hear some of the music on my FDS playlist that we talked about, it's available on my website at memoriesofamoonbird.com. Click on podcast and go to Sarah's episode, and there you will see the songs listed for you. And you know I'm going to say it, while you're there online, please head over to patreon.com/moonbird. That's Patreon, patreon.com/moonbird, and throw a couple bucks to the show to help us keep the lights on. We really appreciate it. And if you want even more Moonbird in your life, and hey, who wouldn't? Head right back to memoriesofamoonbird.com or visit me on social media at Memories of a Moonbird. Keep supporting the arts and stay safe.